We have another afternoon of amazing panels and amazing keynotes. And I just want to say again, none of that would have been possible without the Wallace Action Fund's generosity. So can I hear another round of applause for them? So many people have told me this event is amazing, so it would not have happened without them. It's really important. So our next panel is actually one of the ones I'm very, very excited about. It is called Race, Militarism, and Masculinity. And we have on this panel Stan Goff, Doug Zachary, Courtney Mitchell, and Vince Emanuele. And it is being moderated by the incomparable Gail Dines. Please put your hands together.
Hello? Can everyone hear? Good afternoon, everybody. This looks like a wonderful conference, and I'm so sorry that I didn't get to come here yesterday, but I've got the honour of facilitating this wonderful panel, and I'm going to briefly introduce everybody, and then people are going to speak, and we're going to have questions and answers. So I'm going to start in the order that people will be speaking. Stan Goff is over here. Stan is a Christian communitarian, a former career soldier in the United States Army, and author of several books on the military and militarism. His titles include Hideous Dream, A Soldier's Memoir of the U.S. Invasion of Haiti, Full Spectrum Disorder, oh, I love that one, The Military in the New American Century, Energy War and Sex and War. His latest book, due out from Cascade Books in January, is Borderline, Reflections on War, Sex and the Church. And I think I'm going to leave it at that and let you introduce the rest so that we can get talking, if that works for you. Does that work for you? Okay, and then I'm going to go to, secondly, Courtney is a writer and activist living in northern Georgia. Born and raised in Illinois, Courtney co-authored The Enemy in Blue, the Renata Fraser story, a self-published creative non-fiction work chronicling his mother's fight against racism. He spent 4 years assisting with anti-violence and pro-feminist organizing on campus while in college. He's a member of several international activist organizations and spent 3 years as an infantry soldier in the Georgia Army National Guard, and I'm going to let you continue with the rest of your introduction. Number three is Vince. Emmanuel was born and raised in America's Rust Belt. After two combat deployments in Iraq, he refused orders for a third and immediately began organizing with Iraq veterans against the war, eventually serving on the board of directors for IVAW. Vince has worked with various social movements and has participated in a wide range of campaigns, protests, street theatre, performances, writing workshops and direct actions. He's given talks around the world on topics such as militarism, ideology and resistance. And then we're going to go on to Doug Zachary, who spent the 1950s in a church orphanage in Texas where he was heavily indoctrinated with white male supremacism. The suffering of non-white people was said to be justified because they were children of Ham. All females had to be subordinated because they descended from Eve, Jezebel, and Delilah. Children were in league with nature and the devil, and they required an iron discipline. And I'm going to let you introduce the rest of you. So welcome, everybody. This promises to be an excellent panel, and welcome to our speakers.
I think I just dropped my BART ticket on the floor over here. I'm going to stand over here because they've given us 10 minutes, and I'm going to read some of this, so I keep it down to 10 minutes. Thank you. If I do it trying to hold a mic in the other hand, I'll embarrass myself by dropping my papers all over the floor. I want to respond real quick, and I'm going to dig into my own 10 minutes a little bit here to one of the questions that we were left with, I think, at the last panel. And someone made the remark and sent the remark forward from the audience that rape and environmental destruction are not synonymous. I don't hear very well up here. I don't hear very well at all, but I couldn't hear what Derek's response was going back out. But I want to reiterate what the person said from the audience, because we're talking about ecocide and patriarchy and capitalism as if they're all part of the same dynamic, and they are now because they all exist simultaneously and they interact with each other. But I'm going to tell you the truth. A man can work as a member of a construction crew to build a Walmart and not be a rapist. And a man can work in the environmental movement and be a rapist. And you know, let me say it for the record. Capitalism is bad. Okay? Capitalism is bad. But capitalism grew out of patriarchy. And as far as I can tell from reading my history, war and patriarchy predates capitalism by quite a ways. So I'm just coming from a position that if we're going to look for the deepest roots of the problem, patriarchy is probably one of the first places we need to go. So, yeah. And with that in mind, I mean, I don't want to say that ecocide and race and gender and war and capitalism are all the same thing. But I do want to sort of address something about a common psychology that they all have. There's something they have in common psychologically, and that's part of the psychology of men. 10 minutes is not much time to unpack any aspect of the association between race, gender, and militarism, much less relate that association to the central theme of the conference, which is ecological crisis. So I'm going to bypass the structures and systems and genealogy of this association and just instead suggest a few psychological dynamics that they all have in common as part of the psychology of men. I wrote a book called Borderline, which Gail just talked about, which will be out in a couple months, and it deals with gender and militarism. But while I was writing that book and writing Sex and War before that, I was forced to conclude that racism and environmental crisis are as unavoidable to a discussion of gender and war as gender and war are unavoidable if we want to get a handle on what racism and environmental vandalism is all about. And each of these phenomena shares with the others a set of conceptual coordinates, and I'm going to call these conceptual coordinates the boundary. Some of you who may have read anthropology know Mary Douglas's canonical anthropological study, Purity and Danger, in which she shows how all cultures necessarily inscribe boundaries as prerequisite for coherence and identity, and how these boundaries are internalized by a culture's members as purity and pollution. April Fallon and Paul Rosen have studied the phenomenon of disgust as the experience, the phenomenological experience of that internalization. And Nancy Hartsock and other feminists have shown how boundaries are policed by power in such a way that those with the power can transgress the boundaries where those without the power are either contained within them or excluded without. I want to suggest that in a male-dominated society, not only do men and a few specially privileged women acting within male-dominated structures claim the prerogative to inscribe boundaries and transgress them, and that these boundaries are understood in a particularly military way. I want to further suggest that this is because the practice of war has exercised a powerful formative influence on constructions of masculinity, in as much as war has been and remains a practice, a trans-historical practice, overwhelmingly of men. In a recursive way, too, just as war reproduces violent masculinities reproduce war. Now, disgust psychologists have shown how boundary psychologies involve magical thinking, and an example is what the disgust psychologists call the Dixie Cup experiment. You have people spit into a Dixie Cup, and then you ask them to drink it. The material in the cup is no different than what all of us swallow all day long, yet the fact that it has been expelled across a bodily boundary It changes it magically into something that elicits a disgust reaction. And this magical thinking in part accounts for the promiscuity of disgust and its ability to translate from its most elementary form, which is the resistance to oral incorporation of impure substances, to a socialized form of disgust. And you know, all of us that are my age grew up hearing about somebody who had cooties. You remember that? In the same way, people learn to experience disgust at some generality, for example, like germs that are supposedly threatening to the boundaries of the body, even though, in fact, most microorganisms are either benign or beneficial to human being. We learn disgust at other peoples who might threaten the body of a culture or a nation or a so-called race. And in these few examples, we see nature, foreigners, and racial others as capable of eliciting disgust, which is indoctrinated as part of one's cultural formation. Men are often indoctrinated to feel disgust at the bodies of women because women's bodies are perceived to have permeable boundaries, because women are receptive during reproductive coitus, women menstruate, women have babies, women lactate. And this brings us to the idea of boundary permeability. Who or what can cross boundaries? And this is where you can begin to see war in reality symbol and imagination as the model for boundary policing. Imagine a base in a militarily occupied country. The people are kept outside, and the prerogative to cross the boundary remains with those who have the power. The occupying soldiers can go outside the wire, where they can transgress the boundary to impose their will beyond it, but their refuge and their identity are inside that boundary. And I realize I'm only leaving impressionistic accounts, 10 minutes. But let me add a couple more impressions to kind of flesh out these shared psychologies of war, racialism, the devaluation of women, and the destruction of natural systems. Nancy Hartsock, in her book, which I think is also canonical in some ways, Money, Sex, and Power, explained that sex is understood by many men as an act of aggression and hostility, which we can see in the everyday speech of many males, who use war as a metaphor for sexual conquest and sexual metaphors for war and violence. And we're all familiar with this kind of speech. You can hear it in locker rooms. You can hear it in barracks. You can hear it in frat houses. It's the hieroglyphic, you know. And Hartsock also takes her analysis a step further, and she says that sexual degradation of women by men as a transgression of a boundary is a transgression that carries a thrill with it. She explains that the boundary between the metaphorical virgin and whore is one that men can cross again and again for that same thrill. And obviously there are many examples of this thrill that men experience during the sexual humiliation of women, and it is a very common theme in pornography. As for the common association of sex with aggression, I can only point to the fact that during the run-up to the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, the Shock and Awe condom was marketed with the slogan, "Equipped with Bunker Buster Technology." And finally, I want to talk just a moment about the intersubjective approach to psychoanalysis, which is counterposed to the intrapsychic models of analysis. Intersubjective psychologists like Jessica Benjamin study psychology with an eye to understanding domination. I'm going to give a very unjustly abbreviated account of this approach and just leave you all to consider how it figures in with the ways that men are socialized during early development, how it factors into racism, and how this approach illuminates the language of support for war. Intersubjectivity begins with the tension that we all experience in any relationship with another person. We all need recognition, but only a subject as opposed to an object can grant recognition. And intersubjectivity begins with the tension that we all experience in any relationship with other person. So in every relationship, besides needing recognition, there's also a need for self-assertion. We never imagine a person as they actually are, and so with each misstep in the process of negotiating a new relation, we're psychically forced to destroy and rebuild the other person in our minds. Over time, as we become known to one another, this dynamic of destroying and rebuilding is replaced by a form of attunement. We begin to synchronize, we harmonize, we grow closer. And in this whole process, there's always this tension, this paradox between self-assertion and acceptance. And as long as we can maintain that tension, we have some degree of mutuality. And that's the ability to recognize each other as subjects. friendship or love is well-developed attunement. I can be yours and still mine, and you can be mine and still yours. But when a person loses the ability or refuses to sustain that paradox, the relationship then shifts into a power struggle. It shifts into a quest for control where the relationship converts along an axis of domination and subjugation. And the other person is converted from a subject to an object, which creates a great deal of frustration for the dominant person because only a subject can grant authentic recognition. So as I get closer to closing here, let's consider quickly what the implications are for the formation of very young boys who, generally speaking, form their first and most powerful bond as infants with their mothers. As soon as they begin to understand themselves as males, they are relentlessly indoctrinated to reject and revile everything associated with being female. This early trauma is compounded then throughout the rest of their lives by the mandate to police the impermeable boundaries of toughness and callousness. And to remain in the male fraternity, they have to be willing to prove their masculinity by the objectification of women, of enemies against which they prove themselves, the objectification of nature. That is, they must remain figuratively and sometimes actually at war. Now, I apologize. I don't know how my time. How's my time? My time. I'm getting the. Yep. I apologize. I packed a lot of ideas into a few minutes without adequate clarification. But hopefully we can open these topics up a bit if you're interested in them during the post presentation. And I thank you all very much for your patience and attention. Yeah.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me here. Okay, so I'm going to try to stay. I was told I can take a few more minutes, but I'll try not to take too long. First, I want to give some thanks and gratitude, first and foremost, to the Wallace Action Fund, without whom we would not be here right now. So please join me in thanking the Wallace Action Fund. Also, the conference organizers, Fertile Ground, the venue and staff of the Palace, this beautiful venue that we were given, as well as my fellow panelists, and the absolutely incredible Gail Dines. She is one of my absolute heroes. As well as you all. There is no conference without attendees. You all are our comrades, our allies in this struggle to save what is left on this planet, so thank you very much. I also want to acknowledge the Ohlone people for giving us the permission to occupy their land right here. Thank you. I enlisted in the Georgia Army National Guard in January of 2011. I chose infantry. Originally, my plan was to choose combat medic. The reason why I chose to join the National Guard is the same reason why most people of color decide to join the Army or the military. It was hard finding a job. I was at home with a stepfather that I really could not stand. And I just kind of wanted out. I chose infantry because combat medic would take 3 months to ship to basic training, and infantry was getting me out the very next month. That's why I chose it. Now, when I came out of basic training, it was 14 weeks. It lasted 14 weeks. I don't know if you all know, but the infantry does not separate what they call basic and AIT, advanced individual training. It was 14 weeks straight. I was in the best shape of my life, of course. But I got a huge dose of military chauvinism and racism. Now, many hesitate to use the term brainwashing when it comes to basic training, and I understand that, because you do still have some individuality when you come out of basic training. But there is no doubt that there is psychological conditioning in basic training. Here are some examples. Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, he wrote a book called On Killing. The interesting thing is that my senior drill instructor actually allowed us to read this book, and that was his mistake. He calls it operant conditioning, and that is so true. We have all these different terms, ready ups, which are drills to raise your weapon on command, controlled pairs, so you can shoot very quickly, two shots into the enemy's chest, reload drills, so you can reload faster and shoot again, 3-second rushes, so you can move quickly across the terrain without being hit by the enemy's weapon, silhouetted targets, and these silhouetted targets, it's just like what it sounds like. It's the upper torso silhouette of a human being. It teaches you to shoot first and think later. It creates an instinct. These targets are not shown with weapons. They're simply the torso of a human being. Stress shoots, in which we had to go through a really long and exhausting obstacle course and then shoot at the target. Battle drill 1 alpha. I don't know if you all are familiar with this, but in the infantry, we have battle drills. And these are drills designed to basically engage the enemy in an effective manner and limit casualties. In battle drill 1 alpha, the most important part of it is called assaulting the objective. Let that sink in. Assault the objective. Probably the most stressful part of basic training is corrective training. This is what we call getting smoked. This is what you see in the movies when a drill instructor is yelling and screaming his head off at you, calling you all kinds of names. And please pardon my French right now. I want you all to know what these terms are. I want you to know what it is like to endure this verbal abuse. It is verbal abuse, no doubt. We were called cock holsters. We were called cum dumpsters. We were called faggots. Where do these terms come from? These terms come from pornography. There is an emphasis on breaking down the psyche and the soldier's will to resist. As a matter of fact, there are 3 phases in Army training. There's red phase, white phase, and blue phase. Red phase, according to the training document of the U.S. Army, is referred to as total control. That means the drill instructor has total control over his recruits. You do whatever he says. These drill sergeants showed recruits slideshows of dead and mutilated Iraqi and Afghan people and bragged about it. These drill instructors made rape jokes about their own partners right in front of us and expected us to laugh about it. This is how you turn men into soldiers. It is the same way you turn males into men. It is the same training that we get in this society, in this media, in the government and the military, training us to be militarized and weaponized, use our bodies as weapons against women and against the life on this planet. As a matter of fact, Lear Keith calls it the domination imperative. That is masculinity, a dichotomy of self and other, so that the self becomes the most important part of life and everyone else is an object. It is built on breaking boundaries. That is masculinity. There is an intense peer pressure. It's amplified in the military, but it is present in all male communities. There is a culture of compliance in the military. And you are ostracized for speaking out. You're even physically punished. Again, that's what we call corrective training or getting smoked. By the way, getting smoked, if you ever hear a military personnel say that, getting smoked, you exercise so much, your muscles hurt so much, you're so exhausted, your head is literally smoking. The United States is at war with the Muslim world. There's 2 estimates I want to give you. From 2003 to 2011, an estimated 500,000 war-related deaths in Iraq. But there's another estimate that's even worse. Between 1990 and 2012, wars and economic sanctions against Iraqi people killed an estimated 3.3 million. That includes 750,000 children. The United States is at war with Latin America. Many of you know what the School of Americas is, and I want to acknowledge that this is the 25th year that the School of Americas Watch has been conducting their vigil at Fort Benning. They are there right now. It's a long-sustained resistance against what's happening to the Latin American people and what the School of Americas has done to them. Many have dubbed the School of America's School of the Assassins. That's exactly what it is. The United States, now, the School of America is called these days the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. It's just a euphemism. It's ridiculous. They've trained 64,000 Panamanian soldiers. These soldiers have killed, raped, massacred, tortured, kidnapped, and otherwise forced into refuge hundreds of thousands of Latin American people, including educators, union organizers, religious workers, student leaders, and poor rights activists. They are intentionally targeting the resistance. Former Panamanian President Jorge Lueca stated that the School of the Americas is the biggest force for destabilization in Latin America. This weekend, five activists were arrested at the Stewart Immigrant Prison in Georgia. The Stewart Immigrant Prison is a for-profit prison. I want you all to understand the implication of for-profit prisons. When you create a demand for prisons, you create a demand for racism, you create a demand for all kinds of other social ills. The United States is at war with its own people. A state of emergency and martial law was declared in Ferguson, in Missouri, even before the grand jury decision came out. Military surplus equipment is provided to local law enforcement agencies to use on the streets and in schools. Armored tanks, assault rifles, explosives, drones, military-grade OC spray, and long-range acoustic devices. These police, these vigilantes, they kill an unarmed person of color every 28 hours. Mass incarceration of black men, mass eviction, and criminalization of black women. This is a genocide. Especially considering how militarized police target communities of color. The erosion of civil liberties through mass surveillance and wiretapping and closed-circuit TV security cameras are literally everywhere, and a criminalization of nonviolent protests. Grand jury subpoenas to testify against each other, and FBI harassment and intimidation, outright police brutality against protesters. This is life in a highly militarized culture. The United States is clearly the world's largest and most well-funded terrorist organization. Now, there's a parallel that I want to make with this, and it's something that Stan talked about a lot, that males are socialized to use their bodies as weapons against women. Violence and abuse is marketed as entertainment in this culture. Violent masculinity, class, and white supremacy collide. Now, before I end, I want to talk about an issue that I've wrote about recently, and that is the need for pro-feminist men to step up and take the mantle and do something about men's violence against women. Men, pro-feminist men, and other men of conscience must begin to first name male violence and violent masculinity and actively work for its dismantling. Violent and abusive men are openly calling for mass violence against women. I don't know if you all are familiar with Anita Sarkeesian. She's a social critic and commentator. She has recently been talking about sexism and misogyny in video games. That's all she did, was talk about video games. She wanted to speak on a college campus. The college campus received a threat from a violent man that they were going to massacre people on campus if she came to speak. Elliot Rogers, who killed four people and wounded eight at UC Santa Barbara, wrote a manifesto declaring outright war against women. And Julian Blanc, this fucking guy, calls himself a pickup artist, is training men to use violence and coercion to assault women. This is a war against women. We cannot use any other word for it. Pro-feminist men and men of conscience must start taking these abusers seriously. They aren't just talking about violating women, they're doing it. And I use this language, I understand the implication of it, but these abuses are the enemy, and we have to start treating them as such. We identify the strategic weak points of patriarchy, and we undo this culture from the inside out. We undermine and ultimately dismantle masculine culture, and we hold men accountable for their actions. Yeah. I'll end with this. If you aren't supporting women, then you're supporting the enemy. You cannot sit on the fence on this one. Every 2 minutes, a woman is either raped, beaten, or killed in this world. This is not the kind of world I want to live in, and it's not the kind of world that you want to live in. Thank you.
Well, I prepared a couple of things, but I think all of that's going to go out the window because I really just wanted to come from the gut today. And after talking with Stephanie last night, Dar, speaking with Courtney, talking with Doug, having previous conversations with people like Derek and Lier, it reminds me that some of this people have been doing for some time, and I've been doing this for some time. You know, I come from the Rust Belt. Most of the people I live around are never going to go to San Francisco, because most of them can never afford it. I grew up in a Rust Belt area, it's all steel mill towns. A family that joined the military, grandfathers that were in the military, my dad that was in the military, immigrants from Europe, people who fully identified, I think, with a masculine culture, but then the contradictions were, giving me knowledge about the street as well. Growing up in a place where, people were being shot two blocks from the house. I just wrote an article about being a kid in the Rust Belt and being at a function when I was 8 years old. And, we were at a party. It was a New Year's Eve party. And someone got in an argument with someone downstairs in the basement, and somebody got stabbed. They stabbed him, beat him up. At another party that I was at, my father and another gentleman got in an argument, and my father threatened to blow his fucking head off with the gun that he had. I remember being 6 years old playing army with my friends. As soon as I got a plastic gun at 6, 7 years old, that's when it started. It started playing the violent video games, thinking, oh, if you're a male, you have to be tough, you have to be violent, you can't cry, you treat women a certain way, you treat foreigners a certain way, you treat the environment a certain way. Everything's there to be exploited. Everything there's, it's all for you. People often ask, I've been hearing people throughout the conference, why in the hell would you join the military? As Courtney mentions, there's an economic draft taking place right now. So in the post-2008 world, when people ask, why are these people joining? Well, a lot of the people I know who join, they have nowhere else to go. It is their last option to support their family. And it's tough. It's a tough option for a lot of people to take. But when I chose to go, then I was in high school at the time, and my dad was telling me, well, you're an idiot. I was in during Vietnam. This is crazy. This war's corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. But I didn't listen because I was 17 and I knew better. And so I joined the Marine Corps. And to cut a long story short, and because I don't want to leave this space in too much of a wreck today, my time in the Marine Corps was completely traumatic and brutal. The training, as Courtney mentioned, the racism, the dehumanization, and pardon my language as well, but I want people to understand full well what the hell is going on in the military. We referred to Iraqis and Afghans as sand niggers, hajis, ragheads, camel jockeys. That's what the training was. That was the nomenclature that was used. And a black activist friend of mine a couple weeks ago, Sharon, reminded me. She said, you weren't dehumanizing Iraqis and Afghans, just like black people have never been dehumanized in the United States. And I said, oh my God, what do you mean by this? She said, we were never considered humans to begin with. So the idea that you can dehumanize what many Americans consider a non-human, I think is another angle and another way that we could start framing this discussion. But then, if you bring it to the level that people like Lear and Derek and the folks at DGR, I think, are talking about, then you have to ask, okay, what does it mean to be a human? Why are humans considered more important than everyone else, while simultaneously trying to mend these bridges with communities that had never been considered human to begin with, while some communities live and privilege from that status of being considered fully human? And so what happened in Iraq? Well, I was awoken very quickly. I was a machine gunner, squad automatic machine gunner. My first deployment was cut short because my mother had a brain aneurysm. And when I was flown home, speaking of masculinity and an inability to feel emotions, during my first deployment, my mother had a brain aneurysm. I was flown home for emergency brain surgery, went to Northwestern University Hospital, and stood in the parking lot and smoked cigarettes because I didn't know how to cry. I didn't know how to talk to any of my family. I didn't know how to hug them. I didn't want them to touch me because I had just been through the 18 weeks of training that Courtney previously mentioned. Not only was I no longer a quote-unquote human being, I was a hyper-indoctrinated young male looking for action, excitement, adventure, anxiously awaiting to go back on that second deployment. And then when I went on that second deployment, I had friends, fortunately, who were going to college at the time. You know, so they were coming home giving me Noam Chomsky, Cornel West, Howard Zinn. You know, like I was getting tuned in to kind of what was happening, but I still felt this kinship with the people I was serving with, and I was like, oh, I have to go back. I have to go on this deployment. I got to go. So we went on that deployment, and it was, in my opinion, horrific. Shooting at innocent civilians, playing around with dead bodies, mutilating dead bodies, taking pictures with dead bodies. And then all of this tied to Gail's work. Okay, what were we doing? When I interviewed Gail a couple years ago, she used the term industrialized sex to categorize modern pornography. But what I witnessed was this militarized sex, where women Marines were referred to, WMs, were referred to as walking mattresses. That's how the military leadership in the Marine Corps would refer to women. Now, being in Iraq, the pornography was prevalent. It was always there. It was there in the barracks, people watching pornography in groups sometimes, individually, after patrols. You're out, you're with these, you know, you're seeing all this horrific stuff, and then you're getting back to the barracks room or to your C hut, putting on your laptop and watching pornography after you just killed somebody. So the connections, when Gail mentioned that to me and when she mentioned the connections between militarism, empire, sexual violence, patriarchy, it was beyond clear. It was traumatizing and horrific for me to go ahead and think about it again and to think about what that means for our society. But what that made me also realize is what the U.S. empire does abroad. And because I think Stan and Doug and Courtney are going to provide a real personal narrative, and I was trying to stay away from that so I don't break down today again. We have to start opposing the empire as such. And so when people say, hey, it's police brutality, no, it's policing. Policing is the problem. There's not going to be a better form of policing. It is policing itself. It's not as though you're not going to get a better U.S. empire. The U.S. military and military actions are the problem. You know, I had these conversations over the last couple of years when things in Libya popped up, things in Syria. People were saying, oh, should we be against this? Should we be for this? What does this mean? Is this a humanitarian intervention? Is this this? We have to be opposed to American empire as such. Imperialism, however you want to label it, that's what has to happen. And so I'm going to jump down to resistance because I think we could talk about my experiences in the anti-war movement and how this is all tied to ecology. This should be simple enough. As we know, all previous empires, why did they collapse? They collapsed because of a concentration of economic wealth. They collapsed because they destroyed the natural environment around them. Empires, or miniature empires, as Lear mentions, like cities. So when I've been sitting around the last couple of days, and I guess the questions I have is that I work with a lot of different groups. Okay, so I work with groups that are dealing with a lot of primary emergencies. Groups that are working for home foreclosures, trying to stop mental health facilities from closing, trying to stop public schools from closing. There's a good friend of mine who just got a hold of me last week. There's a woman's clinic in South Bend, Indiana. They're getting death threats. They're getting physical violent threats from some right-wing groups. She got a hold of me. and another female veteran that we know in the area. She wants our veterans group to provide security for that group. Cool, we'll do it. You know, there's local food pantries that we work at. There's environmental actions that we do. We work with a lot of different groups. So when I sit here and I listen to all these different folks speak, like yesterday I'm listening to these indigenous activists talk about their values, experiences, projects, and programs, and I'm thinking, how does this connect with the folks in the Rust Belt that I know who are being racially attacked, who are in Detroit, Michigan, having their water shut off, 2,000 residents every week? How does this tie in with the poor black communities that we work with on the west and the south side of Chicago? How do we make this real for folks? Okay, because the discourses that I hear, and I've been doing this work now for going on 8 years, almost full time, and a lot of different conferences, environmental conferences look totally different than the economic justice conferences I go to. When I was just in Chicago last week for a Veterans Day event, what they called the Fight for 15, I would say a crowd like this, but you know, 90, 95% African American, Latin American. How do we start building those ties with those movements? You know, our experiences in the Rust Belt are drastically different in some ways than what's going on in the Northwest. And those experiences are drastically different in some ways from what's happening in places like Mississippi and Louisiana. But then also, how do we make these international connections? I had a chance to work with Aboriginal groups in Australia last year. Amazing. Amazing. Just sat down, shut up, listened, asked a lot of questions, learned a lot. But they also asked a lot of questions. And the major questions were, how in the hell are people in the empire going to stop the empire? Because that's what we need you to do. And I'll leave with this because I'd rather just open up the conversation. But if we're going to have a serious movement, an anti-empire, anti-militarist movement, I think some of our friends in the crowd would agree, that Syrians, Iraqis, Afghans, Libyans, Palestinians will lead that movement. It will not be led by Americans. That movement must be led by the people who are not only living here now, but the international bonds that we have to create overseas, and also the veterans you see on the stage today, because these folks have a firsthand, including myself, a firsthand knowledge of how corrupt, insane, and murderous this culture and this system is. And for better or worse, and I'm going to leave in a very crass way, I'm going to say this as well, we can use the status of veterans. That is one of the most respected positions in American society. What we've done with that is to be able to get onto programs like CNN, to be able to get onto NPR and all this other bullshit. Now, we don't want to constantly cozy up to the circles of power, as Hedges was mentioning earlier, but if we could get a shot to get somebody like Lear on CNN, I'm sorry, but I would like to see Lear on CNN. And so we have to use that, and we've been able to use that as veterans and being very strategic about it and saying, look, we're going to use these positions to be able to get into these different circles, talk to different groups, labor groups, community groups, all kinds of different groups, and to be able to bring up what's happening to the Iraqis, the Afghans, and the people that the United States Empire is oppressing, because they are the primary victims, not U.S. veterans, although the traumas are severe. And I guess I said I would leave with that, but I'm going to leave with this because it is on a personal note. We've had several members kill themselves this year. We've had several members die of drug overdoses, and my friend Dave and I, who's sitting in the back there today, who served in the same platoon as I did, we've had two members who've died in the last couple years under the age of 30, didn't smoke, didn't drink, didn't do drugs, from cancer. The cancers from the burn pits in Iraq, which are ecological disasters, and the depleted uranium, which is leaving people in Fallujah with cancer rates that are 10 times higher than that in the aftermath of Hiroshima. That's the legacy. It's the suicides, it's the deaths that Courtney's talking about, who Madeleine Albright in the 1990s said, yeah, those 750,000 Iraqi kids, it was worth it. That's the insanity that we're dealing with, and in order to deal with that, I think we have to be very serious, I think we have to be very critical, and I think we have to understand that this machine, this military empire, it will kill every single last one of us until it gets what it wants for this insane culture. And in order for us to stop it, I think we are going to have to put all options on the table, and I think we're going to have to think about what kind of sacrifices we're all going to have to make that a reality.
So before I get started, I'd like to ask a question of the audience, and just show your hands if you will. Is there anyone out here who imagines that a misogynist, male-dominated, male-governed society is going to put an end to war? Raise your hand. That's the same response I get from members of Veterans for Peace, and I've been asking that question often. So what's my focus then? My focus is to smash the patriarchy. So what is masculinity? I really love a certain video that I've come across about gender featuring a young woman named Rachel Ivey, and she says... And she says right off the bat, you know, we're just not going to jump up and start talking about gender. We're going to decide what it is that we're talking about. So what is masculinity? What is masculinity? And I'm informed by my own life, and also informed by theoreticians like Sheila Jeffries, that masculinity is a performance. It's a script. So I'll tell you a little bit of my personal story and why I believe that. I was born to an Okey mom who, at 14 years old, married one of her dad's bootlegging buddies, who was 26. She was a migrant out here in California working in the field. She bore four children before her 21st birthday, married to a violent alcoholic. Before she was 21 years old, Helen Zachary Del Real Acevedo ran off with a Mexican, right? How cool is that? My mom came from a county in Texas that till 1965 had a banner over the entrance to the house, "Welcome to Greenville, Texas, the blackest soil and the whitest people in Texas." And in 1954, the year of the Supreme Court decision that you all know that suggested to the South that they might at least begin to desegregate their schools, my mama stood up and in the face of 5 and 10,000 years of patriarchal prescription about the behavior of girls and women, abandoned her children so that she could have a dignified and decent life, because she would have died, as she told us, squatting there on the kitchen floor the day she left, had she tried to take us with her. Within a few weeks, we were in an orphanage. My dad had no intention of taking care of us. He just wanted to dominate my mother. So we were in a Southern Baptist orphanage during the McCarthy era, right at the end of the Korean War. This is a segregated institution, Buckner Orphans Home is. And in the 10 years that I was out there, I met one black person, and he worked on the swine farm, J.D., and he lived with his children out there in enforced squalor. And that's all I knew about black folk, except, of course, what the good Lord told us, right? That they're suffering because of something somebody did 5 or 10,000 years ago. Some Jewish guy named Ham failed to obey the Jewish God, and therefore black people must suffer. And this is what the Southern Baptist Church, which came into existence over the issue of a slave owner being able to preach on Sunday mornings in 1834, hasn't backed away or apologized in any serious way since then, because they're still a racist institution. They support the state. They support racism in every possible way. They're a total war outfit, that church is. So I entered this institution when I was 4 years old. I was in the Sunbeam dormitory for preschoolers for 2 years. I entered the institution a wounded child, emotionally disturbed. And I expect that of the 500 children out there at Buckner Orphans Home, there were probably 500 emotionally disturbed children. But we came from a situation where we could have died. Later, there were murders in my family. We could have died, and we were afraid, my brothers and I. And so going into that institution was in some way a relief. For 2 years, I was in the preschool dorm, and at 6 years old, they separated us by sex and began the engendering process. All the boys marched across campus to Pyrese Dormitory. We were introduced to some of the meanest people I've ever met in my life, the dorm matrons there. They had a court system where the boys daily met in court and brought each other up for charges and then administered the punishment, decided on the punishment, and administered the punishment. I was an emotionally disturbed child, and I peed on myself every night while I was asleep. And when I woke up, I was grilled about that. I was brought before court. I was convicted. Everyone was always convicted. And then I had to walk a gauntlet of my peers naked while 30 boys beat me with their belts, down and back. We're in Pyrese dorm for 4 years old, from age 6 to 10. At 6 years old, you put on your first football helmet at Buckner Orphan's Home, too. And my older brother was a football hero. And I could lean into that a little bit. With what was going on in that dormitory, every chance I got an opportunity to hurt one of those boys in athletics, I took it. I fucking took it. We knew in Pyrese dorm, the way we put it, we had a hierarchy. We knew who could beat first in Pyrese dorm. And to this day, half a century later, I know that Jackie Yates could beat first, that Kenny Isaacs could beat second. One weekend, we were on furlough up at my grandmother's house, and my father and his brother got into a brutal fight. My father was beaten almost to death with a tire tool. We're drinking whiskey and changing tractor tires. That's dangerous, especially if you're a fool-ass cracker. So Daddy almost died, and the rest of the family was cheering that crap on, right? Somehow or other, he regained consciousness and got us back to Buckner, you know, before Monday morning, and didn't come to see us for a long time after that. What I learned from that incident with my father, I learned from my uncle. I learned that if you're going to hurt somebody, hurt them, you know. So I wasn't ranked as a bedwetter, as a victim of the Beltline. That translated into playground stuff. It was understood I couldn't whip nobody. So if you wanted to hurt somebody, there was Doug Zachary. But after that weekend, I went back to the orphanage. I went back to the dormitory, and I called out Kenny Isaacs, number two. And he and I stood there just pounding each other until the adults finally came. We always hid where the adults couldn't find us when we were doing this hierarchical crap, right? So we stood there pounding each other and eventually crying. We were both standing there just hitting each other as hard as we could and crying. But that was the last day I got abused on the playground. And that was the beginning of my masculinity. That's masculinity. It was a performance. I had to perform. And I somehow understood it as a performance. I think because living in that environment, in that dormitory, I was a pariah. You've all heard of the Lord of the Flies. I was Piggy, right? Living in there, I was an outsider. I was a part. And I somehow could see what was going on. And I felt that although it wasn't me, that I could play this role. And I played the role. And as Sheila Jeffries says so well, it's not a natural state. It's a script. It's a performance. And I knew that for a long time, but I didn't know what to make of it. At 13 years old, we got out of an institution. Within a year and a half or so, I knew I just couldn't live with authority. So at around 15, I was out on the streets and on my own. By the time I was 18 years old, I was exhausted. I was exhausted. I was on the streets of Los Angeles in December of 1968, and it was the coldest, wettest December in history in California. And I was wet. I had one change of clothing. I was soaked to my skin. No more money for alcohol. I was afraid. I was a big 200-pound jock kid, right? People a lot bigger than me down there on those streets. And I was frightened, and the Marine Corps recruiting station was right there. So I went into the Marine Corps. In the Marine Corps, I excelled. A bunch of mama's boys. All of them had a mama. You know, they had all had a home. So I excelled in the Marine Corps until I got home on leave. I had I was supposed to have 2 weeks. I took six. The reason that happened is because some of my high school friends got together with me, and Beverly Patron sat across the table from me and said, "Doug, what's your position on Vietnam?" And I'm a 19-year-old Marine with my social background, and it had never occurred to me that I had any business having a position on anything, much less politics in Vietnam. But that set me to thinking. And not just Beverly, but everybody else I'd hung out in high school had become awakened while I was off getting tortured in fucking boot camp. So nobody was leaving me alone about this stuff. So I went AWOL. But I got scared after about a month, and then I reported in down to the station in Tennessee. Other people were coming in late. One boy that I'd been in boot camp came in with a bottle of 200 Somonix and killed himself the first night. That was the first death I knew in the Marine Corps. Within a few weeks, John McCabe, the boy I joined the Marine Corps with, the boy I rode a bus down with from Los Angeles, who had suffered a massive beating in the last 2 weeks of boot camp because our squad had lost a rifle competition, killed himself. We were not going to deploy. We were avionics. I was a fire control systems technician on Phantoms. That meant that I repaired aircraft that dropped napalms. You've seen those pictures from Vietnam where the napalm bombs are exploding in the wake of the aircraft. And I made that possible. But I wasn't going to have to suffer war. I wasn't going to have to suffer it the way that my friend Paul back here did, or the way that my brother over here did, or his comrade. But there was a disturbance in the barracks. And the disturbance in the barracks was led by black infantry who had been to Vietnam and who had long been prison in Vietnam, LBJ prison it was called, Long Bend Jail, LBJ, had come together in a form of resistance and begin to deconstruct that war. And here they were in the barracks talking about race and class. I'd never heard anything like that in my life. And I was paying rapt attention. It made sense of my life. Most of my friends were turning themselves in because we were all doing LSD. Timothy Leary was living 12 miles away in Laguna Beach. And Lord, oh Lord, you know, I was tripping 5 or 6 times a week sometimes. And that affected me a bit. So a lot of my friends were turning themselves in for drugs. I went to my CO, commanding officer, and just told him I quit, but I'm going to stick around and see what you people think of that. And I was eventually discharged as a conscientious objector on the day that the young people at Jackson State were murdered. And for 20 years, I described that as I was discharged in the month of Kent State. So I'll have to let that go. You know, I'm going to have to write the story, and I'll do that later. But tomorrow morning, I'm headed to Ferguson, Veterans for Peace's office. Our office is a couple of blocks from the courthouse in St. Louis County, and we're doing jail support on these activities. Our executive director is a black man connected to the struggle in the county. And y'all come to Ferguson. We need help there this week. We need help. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, I want to thank you all for wonderful speeches, very moving as well, and lots of food for thought. So I'm going to ask a question that kind of throws a spanner in the works of this. And the first question from the audience is, do you perceive men and masculinity to be victims of capitalism, war, society, and patriarchy? So turning it around on itself, and in what way do you think men are victimized by all of these? Do you want to go in the order you spoke in? And I ask to keep it brief so that people can also speak as well.
I'm sorry?
I said, you know, let's keep it brief so we can move along with different questions.
Yeah. I don't hear very well. I'm sorry. Yeah.
The question was, basically turning it around on its head, can you perceive of men being victims of masculinity, capitalism, war, patriarchy?
Yes, and I say that. I think we have to be very careful about that, because right now there's this really reactionary men's movement out there that wants to say, you know, we've been victimized by feminism and all that stuff. And it's real easy to sort of get caught up in that and say, you know, men suffer from patriarchy too. Well, it's true, but it's not true in the way that they mean when you see these reactionary men's movements pop up, because they're completely reactionary. Men are damaged. I think I alluded to that when I talked about early childhood development for males. Whenever we have to separate from our mothers, you know, and begin to deny the most important relationship of our life as part of our sexual development, or as part of our gender development. But that is not. That's not to say that we're suffering on parity with the suffering that we inflict on women as men. I think that's why it's kind of a minefield question. You got to be really careful. But everybody kind of wants to claim their status as a victim sometimes, you know. I'm not here to claim status as a victim. I'm one of those God botherers, you know. I'm calling men to repentance. You know, it's not about us being victims. We need to turn around. We need to do something different. That's not to say we're not damaged by it. One of the reasons that I talk about war, I'm honestly a little uncomfortable sometimes with some of the verbiage that I've even heard during this conference, because I hear a lot of war metaphors. We talk about all this fighting, and we're going to smash things, and we're going to kill people, and we're going to do all this other stuff, that reads a lot better than it lives, you know. It reads a lot better than it lives. We're damaged by this the same way that every oppressor is damaged, the way that the master is damaged by his relationship to the slave. But it doesn't change the fact that it's still the slave that's on the receiving end of the worst of it. You know?
Want to carry on? Have you got an answer to that, Courtney?
What I wanted also to say is that men who claim to be the primary victims of masculinity and patriarchy are ignoring the fact that we obtain an immense amount of privilege from our violence and domination of the life on this planet. And it's really important for men to start talking about this issue. I like the term you used, damaged, but also developing a much more nuanced and critical analysis of this. And the idea of privilege, every single day, like I said, every 2 minutes, a woman is either a man beats, rapes, or kills a woman somewhere in the world every 2 minutes. Women are the primary victims. Children are the primary victims. Life on this planet is the primary victim. And in order for us to start talking seriously about overturning this culture of violence, men have to start undoing masculinity. And I think the way we do that is holding each other accountable and recognizing that there are abusers and that men are the ones who are abusing, and start naming that problem. It's the same thing when we talk about white supremacy or Western hegemony over the world. It's an issue of privilege. The society rewards that type of behavior. And I know that's not something that a lot of people want to hear, but violent masculinity in this culture makes it so that women live every single day of their lives in fear. I used to give these presentations on campus. My background is in pro-feminist education, and I used to teach on college campuses. And one of the exercises we used to do with students is, we would, you know, it would be a mixed class student, women and men, and we would, you know, have everyone in the class raise their hand if you've ever carried mace. Raise your hand if you've ever cuffed your keys walking to your car in a parking lot. Raise your hand if you've ever crossed the street when you saw a man walking towards you. Not a single man in the room would raise their hand. So to say that men are victims is a cop-out. That's what it is. It's ignoring the true scale of the problems.
But I'd like to add into that, though, that whereas I don't think there's any documentation of slave owners having PTSD, we have huge documentation. So I think we can't get away from that. And, of course, the poorer you are and the more of colour you are as a man and the more PTSD you are, the more less likely you are to get any help. So I would bring that into the mix as well.
Go ahead.
I think I would be better serve myself and anyone, for that matter, were I had to be careful to think about my own behavior since I turned 13 years old, because I've got a little while yet to deconstruct that in terms of the way I have acted out male privilege before I started looking at women as the perpetrators of anything.
Okay, another question. How can one sort of fight, combat, stop systems of dominance and oppression, for example, like patriarchy or capitalism, without actually perpetuating the same values of force and dominance? So basically, I suppose the question is, how does one have a revolution that does not then reproduce the same poison that we're trying to get rid of? So that's a hard one.
I would lead this back into what I was trying to get at with who would lead the anti-war movement. So I think the movement, for instance, if you're going to have a real anti-militarist, anti-empire movement, I think would be more inclined to reproduce those systems of oppression if led by the same people who have been benefiting and reproducing those systems of oppression forever. So again, this brings us back to why should Palestinians, why should Iraqis, why should Syrians, why should Afghans, why should those folks be the ones who are making the primary decisions, setting the values, setting the mission statements, and asking for permission before we start doing actions or before we start spouting off what a bunch of white people in a group in San Francisco think people in Afghanistan want. I think that's a very easy, a very simple, and a very sort of pragmatic way to, I don't know if that's going to solve everything, but I do know that that's where it has to start. And it's the same thing we see, as Courtney mentioned, with male violence. I mean, obviously, women have to lead that movement. We didn't go to that woman's clinic in South Bend and say, hey, look, we want to provide protection for you guys because we're big, tough veterans. No, they came to us because they know that we share similar values, and they said, we know that a lot of you have concealed carry permits. Are you interested in coming out to the clinic and standing on the sidewalk, women, veterans, male veterans, etc.? But again, that was a female who reached out to the organization and said, hey, look, like, this is what we're doing. We've already come up with what we want. Can you follow our rules? Can you follow our values? Can you go to this action and participate? And we agreed.
Okay, so I have a question also to ask as someone, of many of us who've been in this for 20, 30 years, and that, you know, women are really sick of mopping up after men. You know, we clean up your dishes, we clean up all the messes you make, we're fed up basically with it. So what I would like to say is, what role do you think men can play in helping feminists, not taking over, like you said? But, I mean, we do want a movement, because basically men are not used to listening to women, right? They basically think about fucking women and then moving on, not listening to us. So how can you basically be out there getting men, especially young men, like feminism did for me as a young woman? Originally, you know, feminism was there to help me figure out what it meant to be a strong, powerful feminist. What role do you see men playing in helping young men, and I'm thinking especially young men of colour as well, where they've had a huge amount of older men denied them, being locked in the prison industrial complex. So what role do you think men can play in getting men to raise consciousness about this? How can you go out into the world and bring all your insights and knowledge and understanding that, you know, you've earned all those insights? How can you then help young men not make those horrible mistakes that they make in the world?
It's I work for Veterans for Peace, and I'm a membership coordinator. It means a lot of things, and in large part it means I listen to men. Of course, I listen to dissident military men, right? I'm already listening to some men who've taken some positions. And when I suggest that they look a little closer at their own behavior when they begin to whine to me about their relationships, I find that our milieu is somewhat probably more open toward moving in that direction than are most men. But that doesn't mean that we're not a sexist organization and that we're not sexist folks. You know, we've got a lot of work to do among men in the movement, and that could be a program in and of itself.
I think I want to add to that, especially for young men of color. One of the things that I like to think about a lot is this idea of countering the culture. And the culture has a hegemony. The culture is hegemonic. That means it dominates the ideological landscape upon which we can, you know, determine our actions. You cannot compete with the culture. The culture is inundated with propaganda. It is inundated with rewards and privileges for those who acquiesce and follow along. What we have to do is start undoing the culture from the inside out. And the way we, I think, in my opinion, the way we can do that is having these dialogues with men one-on-one and challenging them and getting them to ask those questions. Now, I was lucky. I was in a college course that taught me pro-feminism. I mean, we got taught to give presentations to students. I got credit for that course, and so it was in my best interest to do well in it. And then they sent us out as peer educators to educate. But a lot of men don't have that. That's a privilege. A lot of men don't have that privilege. What we do have are the words of women. We have the words of women's experiences. We have the words of women's ideas and their contributions to this. And I think men just have to start listening to women and start understanding what it is that women, that men put women through on a constant basis. And then we take that information to other men and stop just leaving that work to women. And we as men who are privileged start to take on that responsibility.
And we've got one last question.
Yeah.
Yeah, go.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't know any movements. I don't think you can build a movement. I think movements are a confluence of social conditions, and then people can find their way to feed into moments. And sometimes, you know, the moment is just not right for a movement. But and I don't know if it's right for a movement right now or not. The only thing I know how to do right now, I've tried banging my head against the wall other ways, I just write books. And at least some people might read the books, I don't know how much, but maybe the first thing we can do is pick up after ourselves. You know? Just pick up after ourselves, you know? And maybe in small pieces, you know?
Yeah, I would just, and this is totally jumping off. I mean, I know everybody had limited time. There's something that I talked with my friend Aaron Hughes and Graham and Dave about yesterday, and the only thing I'd like to mention as well is that I've heard a few, like, some disparaging comments this week and about people, and like how brainwashed and like how stupid and programmed and like tied into electronics and da-da-da-da-da. And I had a great conversation with Stephanie McMillan last night at dinner. And I think the distinction that both her and I don't want to speak for her, but I'll speak for myself, that I would like to make. In my experience with the war, I don't have to go into black communities and explain why the United States isn't the greatest country in the world. When we're doing work in Latin American communities, I don't have to explain why the war on drugs is militarized, inherently racist, and insane, and works for the capitalist system. Like, when we talk about humanity or humans or this culture, whatever, I do think we need to be very careful, because people know that they're being fucked. Okay, when I go to Gary or Detroit or Milwaukee or the south side of Chicago, like, I just think it's very pretentious for folks to say, oh, you know, all these people are brainwashed, they don't have their consciousness, blah, blah, blah. No, there are people, okay, but the left is not fucking organizing those communities because they're scared to go into those communities. And I just have to say, Somebody mentioned Ferguson, and I don't want to start rambling, but we went there 3-4 days after it happened. I'm sitting at my computer, and I'm saying, I don't have any events lined up. Nothing's going on. The least I can do with that privilege that we're speaking about, but taking the lead from my black organizing friends in Gary, Indiana, who said, hey, Vince, let's go down to Ferguson. Let's put our money where our mouth is. Put your ass on the line. Get out there. Get in front of those police lines and so forth. And all I'm saying is the activists down in Ferguson said, where the hell are all of your white friends? Okay, are they scared to come here? You know, the Washington Post just did a poll not too long ago, said 70% of Americans only, 70% of white Americans have a black friend. 70% of Americans, white Americans, okay? So the segregation in Chicago school system is worse than it was in 1969. I do think all of this discourse is awesome, but I think we have to bring it really down to those basic levels, get in those communities, go to the meetings, you know, donate some of your time, work with groups you don't normally work with, and work in communities that you don't normally organize in.
So I would like to thank you all very much for a great discussion. And I would like to say one thing, if I may, just in closing, as someone who teaches, is that patriarchal, racist capitalism is like a house of cards. You take one away, the whole thing falls apart. It really doesn't take much. When people are not stupid, you give them a bit of counter-hegemonic way of thinking, and it is astounding. It is a domino effect where they begin to see all the lies on which this is built. So I think that we need to think about how we go in there, and we offer counter-hegemonic ways of thinking, and we help, and they help us organize, because that's the kind of stuff to do with community. And I think it's great to have men sitting here, not basically saying how awful it is to be a man, but fighting for the rights of women. That is what is wonderful as well. So thank you very much, everyone.
I'm not worried about me.